everyone. Happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Merry Christmas. Wonderful winter solstice. Whatever is your winter vibe, it's a good one to you. I'm just cracking up listening to all of this stuff on the news about how other people who celebrate other holidays are trying to hijack Christmas. It really, I find it really, really very entertaining. It's good to be here with you guys again. My name is Carla Wills Brandon, and this is A Walk to the Other Side. On this show, we break down the walls of silence and imprisoned discussion about life after death adventures, experiences that everyday people just like you and me are having every hour of every day. The veil between life and death is just that. It's just a veil. There's nothing to fear, but we live, unfortunately, in an extremely youth-obsessed, death-phobic society that is basically run by different types of fundamentalist religions where clergy and clerics and folk use religious tenets to scare the credence out of all of us. It's used as control, it's used as power, and we're basically scared to death with the concept of death. So this is a show that says pooey on that. If you have a comment about tonight's show or any of my other programs, please feel free to email me at drsbrandon@sdcglobal.net. Well, gang, a couple of weeks ago I was in Galveston, Texas, and it was balmy and it was warm and we had Dickens on the Strand and people were dressed in Victorian costumes and there were ghost tours and bagpipes and it was such a blast. And now I'm back in Asheville, North Carolina, high up in the Smoky Mountains, and it's cold up here. It was 18 degrees last night. I've got the potbelly stove burning up a storm, and my dog is sitting at my feet, and I'm wrapped in my grandmother's afghan. I think I was wrapped in the same afghan at Thanksgiving when I did the show from up here. We had a winter storm earlier this week. Basically, they had a horrific ice storm that came through here and shut down schools and shut down businesses. And this afternoon, we went up to the mountains a little bit higher, and there was snow everywhere. Lucky for us, unlike last year, we didn't have any broken pipes. Last year when we showed up at this time of the year, we walked in and there was no water. And so what we ended up doing is hoisting water up to the cabin, heating it up, and putting it in the bathtub. And my kids thought that we were camping. They thought that was great fun. But anyway, we've got water. I've got the fire going. Everybody is fed and I've got one in one room watching some strange movie and another in another room playing some strange Game Boy game. And all the animals are inside, so I don't have any popsicle kitties or doggies. And I even got my pet turtle up here, so I think it's going to be a great holiday season for us. Let's begin by taking a look at what's in the news, a never-ending source of cheap entertainment. I may have shared this with you guys already. I don't remember, but it still blows me away. This is an article that came out of, actually, a Texas newspaper, and it's called Otherworldly Benefits, and it's out of Des Moines, Idaho. No, Des Moines, Iowa. and here's what it says. It says, here's an out-of-this-world reason you can't be denied unemployment benefits in Des Moines. Seeing ghosts on the job. Now, can you believe this? Can you believe they're actually writing about this? The issue ended up in court when a security guard, Wade Galagos, alerted his supervisor at Neighborhood Patrol in September the ghosts were haunting a neighborhood he was guarding. I may have shared this with you, but it still cracks me up. The supervisor arrived at the scene, and Galagos showed him where the ghosts were still apparently standing. Supervisor claimed he saw nothing and fired Galagos 5 hours later. I guess he thought he was nippy. But the company found no signs of drug use or alcohol. When Galagos applied for unemployment benefits, the neighborhood patrol refused, arguing that he was guilty of misconduct. He was guilty of misconduct because he saw ghosts. Lord help me, I should have been fired 50 times over. This month, Judge G. Ken Rinnegard disagreed. While he acknowledged that such beliefs do render a claimant unfit to act as a security guard, so this guy is seen as unfit because he can see ghosts. Rinnegard ruled that seeing ghosts is not the type of misconduct that can disqualify Galagos from receiving benefits. I'm telling you, gang, we've got a long, long way to go. Well, here's something interesting. This has been kind of roaming around the net. If you want to see the picture that goes along with this story, go to Google and plug into your search engine a Christmas ghost. And what you will see is a photograph of a woman sitting in a chair, and behind her, it looks like the silhouette of an old man. Now, when I found this, there was a lot, the skeptics were out in full force, of course, and they were talking about how this was probably hodgepodge. I will tell you, if you go get a disposable camera and you go to a cemetery and you take pictures around a fresh grave, chances are pretty good you might come up with some orbs. I've taken photographs at lots and lots of different places, houses, old houses, places where there have been tragedies. They've come up with some interesting pictures. Well, anyway, this says, this picture is so freaky. My coworker Mary, that lives in Stockton, I'm assuming Stockton, California, bought her sister a digital camera for Christmas. Her sister took a picture of their niece. I guess that's who this girl is sitting in this chair. And if you look behind the chair, the niece is sitting on, you will see Mary's grandfather who passed away 2 months ago in October. Remember, this picture was taken on Xmas Day morning. And I was also with Mary when she bought the camera at Circuit City the day after Thanksgiving. Her grandfather was cremated and his ashes are at Mary's home. Isn't that interesting? When I saw this picture, it gave me the chill. If you can make the picture bigger, you can also get a better look at him. So, I mean, all you have to do is go on the net and plug in, to go to Google or go to your search engine and just plug in ghost pictures, pictures of orbs, vortexes, and you'll see that this is not an unusual phenomenon at all. As a matter of fact, I just had a bunch of film developed of a cemetery that I took pictures at. I gave the kids each digital cameras, and we went out to a cemetery. Yeah, I'm kind of a strange mom. We actually went out to the cemetery where the family of the cabin that we have here in North Carolina is buried. We took some pictures, and we saw a few little orbs, but it looked like in that cemetery everybody had left town. Nobody was hanging around. Okay, so here's another story from CNN, a December story. This actually was printed a couple of years ago, and you may have heard about this, but I wanted to share it with you anyway, because I'm going to London in a couple of weeks. I like to go back to London periodically. I'm going to be actually presenting a paper on the Holocaust. You know, we have the president from Iran who is telling everybody that the Holocaust never happened. Well, he needs to talk to my aunt. I was in Auschwitz a couple of years ago. But anyway, I'm going to be there with a bunch of scholars from Europe and a few from the U.S., and I'm going to be presenting on Hitler's Holocaust and Stalin's gulags. And so while I'm in London, I usually like to go around and I like to take photographs at castles, and I'm going to go back to the old Templar Church. It's a round Knights of Templar Church that was built centuries ago. It's incredible, and this time I'm going to take some photographs there. But anyway, are there ghostly goings on at Henry VIII's palace? Or is that hazy image of a fellow in fancy robes just a bit of Christmas cheer? You may have seen this on CNN News, where the closed-circuit security cameras at Hampton Court Palace, a huge Tudor castle outside London, is absolutely drop-dead gorgeous, seem to have snagged an ethereal visitor. Could it be a ghost? We're baffled, too. not a joke. We haven't manufactured it, said Vicki Wood, a Hampton Court spokeswoman, when asked if the photo the palace released was a Christmas hoax. We genuinely don't know who it is or what it is. I'm going to tell you something. In the U.S., we're a little more guarded about talking about ghosts and things of that nature. In England, it seems like everybody's got some ghost story. Oh, my gosh. And if you go up to Scotland, they'll talk your ear off about ghosts and spirits. And, there's some wonderful facilities up there. There's actually a monastery way out on one of the islands north of Scotland. And this editor friend of mine used to go stay out there. And people out there would always talk about spirit happening. Anyway, Wood said security guards had seen the figure in closed-circuit television footage after checking it to see who kept leaving open one of the palace fire doors. In the still photograph, the figure of a man in a robe-like garment is shown, stepping from a shadowy doorway, one arm reaching out for the door handle. I remember seeing this. It was really, really pretty interesting. The area around the man is somewhat blurred, and his face appears unnaturally white compared to his outstretched hand. I don't know. See, that's kind of suspicious. It was incredibly spooky because the face just didn't look human, says James Fox, one of the palace security guards. Now, I do have to tell you, for those of you who have been to the UK, if you have ever gone to any of these tourist places, these security people, they take things pretty seriously. I mean, they really, really do. So these guys usually are your basic bangers and beans for breakfast. Go get a couple of beers at the pub after work sort of guys. So they're not the type of individuals who just suddenly make this stuff up. That's been my experience. My first reaction was that someone was having a laugh, so I asked my colleague to take a look. We spoke to our costume guides, but they don't own a costume like that worn by the figure. It's actually quite unnerving, Fox said. The palace, built in 1525 from the River Thames, 10 miles west of central London, as I said, is drop-dead gorgeous. If you're ever in London, go check it out. It's a popular tourist attraction, and some of the guides wear costumes to Tudor period. Wood said she was hoping people would come forward with similar stories and try to explain the figure. The palace has been the scene of many dramatic royal events and already is supposed to have a few ghosts. King Henry VIII's third wife, Jane Seymour, died there giving birth to a son, and her ghost is said to walk through one of the cobbled courtyards carrying a candle. Her son Edward had a nurse called Sybil Penn who was buried in the palace grounds in 1562. In 1829, her tomb was disturbed by building work, and around the same time, an odd whirling noise began to be heard in the southwest wing of the palace. I'm going to check that out when I'm there. When the workmen traced the strange sounds to a brick wall, they uncovered a small forgotten room containing an old spinning wheel, just like the one Penn used to use. Henry's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, condemned for adultery, was held at the palace under house arrest before her execution at the Tower of London. Been there, seen it, very, very creepy. What a good guy he was. Axe murdered his wife. An 1897 book about the palace says she was reportedly seen dressed in white and floating down one of the galleries uttering an earthly shriek. Now, I never heard that, but, you know. The palace was once a prison for King Charles I, who later was beheaded. They liked to behead people back then. My son, I'll never forget, he walked up to the stone where one of Henry VIII's wives were beheaded, crawled up on top of it, and sat on it, and insisted I take his picture. Okay, but speaking of the disease, I'm going to depart from my regular discussion of spirits, and I want to talk about, I want to go back and I want to talk about another type of ghost. This is the season to appreciate one another, to explore our likes and our differences. There is always some idiot who does come along and tries to wreck good cheer for all of us. And as I said earlier, this week in the news, it was the Iranian president, And this week in the news, out of the United Nations, I read this just horrible article. It's horrible. The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan today reacted against the reported denial of the Holocaust by Iran's president and urged all countries to educate their people about the well-established historical facts on the genocide. There's genocide happening all around us, gang. All around us. The Holocaust isn't the only event. The Holocaust has been well documented. Lots of survivors have come forth. For years, people did not talk about it, but now they are talking about it. But there have been Holocausts in Russia. There have been Holocausts in Africa. There are Holocausts in Iraq. Holocausts everywhere. Man's inhumanity to man. Sometimes it really does just get to me. Talk about stirring up evil left and right. But anyway, this following article, I mean, it's interesting that right after I read this article, I came across this other article. When I was at Auschwitz, there's a very weird sense about the place. First of all, the energy is incredibly dark. If you have ever been to a place where there has been a lot of tragedy, you'll feel the tragedy. There's just a sense of forebodingness. It feels heavy. It feels sad. People who are sensitive can really pick this stuff up very, very fast. People who are psychic oftentimes have a hard time being in these places. I found Auschwitz to be just an overwhelming experience. Walking around the grounds, looking at some of the death camps, listening to my aunt describe what she went through while she was there, what the Nazis did to her, the death of her mother, the imprisonment of her father in a gulag in Siberia while her brother was in Auschwitz with her. And so when I was there, you could sense the evilness. I received an email from a gentleman who actually spent the night there, and he heard wailing in the night, and he said that it really seriously overwhelmed him. Other people have reported to me that they have heard cries in the death camp. I really do think that sometimes when people are confronted with tragedy and they die by the hand of tragedy, they don't go directly to light. They stay stuck in some sort of reenactment of the tragedy until they're released. And there are people out there who actually make a living out of going to some of these places and doing releases, spirit releases. But ghostly wind blows uneasy through the trees at Auschwitz. This was an article that I came across right after I had to listen to this idiot from Iran talk about how Auschwitz was a mess. This is called Christmas at Auschwitz. And written by Dave Perry. Interestingly, out of something called Furniture Today. And he writes, "That's a bizarre thought, I must admit. It's a strange, unsettling coupling of the holy and the unholy. Is it even possible for Christmas to exist in a place where terror and death once reigned so evilly? But as we move deep into the holiday season, I can't help but think about that horrible juxtaposition as I reflect on a remarkable article that recently appeared in Furniture Today. Headline, Poland Visits Stir Ghosts of the Past. Story told about a trip to Auschwitz made by members of a Furniture Today-sponsored retail delegation. Can you believe this? A group of retail delegates makes a trip to Auschwitz. All right, team. The team was to visit furniture manufacturers in Poland. Poland's a fascinating place. I mean, it's really opened up. For those of you who are big on traveling, I love traveling the East Bloc countries. Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Belarusia. I'm going to try to go to Russia later next year in September. But it's opening up, and it's very, very interesting. It's like Americana hasn't gone in there and planted fast food restaurants yet. So if you like to travel and you want an adventure, get on over there. two of the retailers asked tour organizers to set time aside to visit Auschwitz. The people with some humanity. What resulted was an emotional reminder of a not-too-distant horror of the Holocaust. Thomas Russell wrote in a moving account of the experience. He was among the visitors to the infamous death camp. His story, which appeared in, obviously, their November issue, is interesting reading. I didn't want to go, but I felt I had an obligation to go. I feel everyone of Jewish heritage has an obligation to go to make sure it never happens again. I guess this guy was Jewish. It is one of the major examples in history of man's inhumanity to man. That article spoke of a clear day at Auschwitz and well-kept grounds. That's very creepy, too. Let me tell you, the grounds are pristine. So you have these pristine grounds. You walk into these rooms where there are piles of suitcases that were confiscated from the Jews. There are rooms where there are piles of human hair and even things made out of human skin. And the grounds are well-kept. I could almost feel the wind whistling through the tall trees, silently lining the roads in well-ordered columns through the camp. What spirits were traveling in those winds? What horrors had they seen played out below? What were they saying on that clear sunny day when U.S. retailers walked on those former killing fields? As I studied the picture of the stately trees at Auschwitz that accompanied the story, I wondered if they were there during the Holocaust. No, they weren't. Probably not, I concluded. Why would the Nazis care about bringing life to a place of death? I decided the trees must have been planted after the war, and in those trees I saw evidence that nature can work her magic even in a place as terrible as Auschwitz. God's rain falls on the just and the unjust. Trees grow wherever they are planted and nurtured. Christmas and Hanukkah come to every part of the world. In some places they are welcomed, and in other places they are scorned. Yes, Christmas comes to Auschwitz and Hanukkah too. Hope, like a sturdy tree, can take root almost anywhere. Nature's cycle of renewal ceaselessly moves on. So does mankind's cycle of life. There will be sunny days and stormy days at Auschwitz. But though, through it all, we must never forget what happened in that death camp. I went to this death camp several years back with my aunt who had survived the terror of the Nazis. It was a moving experience for me, and when I came home, I wrote several articles on my experiences over there. As I said, one can feel the sadness and the evil. And like I said, I've received emails from individuals who have had paranormal experiences at Auschwitz. People often ask me, do Jews have after-death communications? Do you know that because I'm Jewish, there is this belief that I shouldn't be into the afterlife. There is this belief that all Jews, that we don't believe in the afterlife, that we don't believe in near-death experiences, that we don't believe in out-of-body experiences. Where this poppycock came from, I'll never know. And so I always have to tell people, well, yes, I'm Jewish. I'm a practicing Jew. But basically, I believe that all religions lead to the same place. My path just happens to be Judaism, but yeah, I believe in out-of-body experiences, after-death communications, deathbed visions. So leaving the status of Auschwitz, let me share this Hanukkah after-death communication with you. We all need to practice some tolerance for each other, whether we are Christians or Muslims or Buddhists or Jews, because in the end, gang, you know what? Once this physical body of ours is ready to be recycled back into Mother Earth, the spirit within each of us is the same. So, anyway, I found this really cute Hanukkah ghost story that I want to share with you. And this story comes from Cup of Soup, Cup of Soup website. I went to this website, and it's very cute. It's sort of a hippy-dippy site for Jews. It's got some chicken soup stuff and some cute little stories. And this woman had some sort of encounter with a deceased relative, and she documented it. She's also very out there about being Jewish. So this is called the Hanukkah Ghost Story. Maybe it was because Bob and I were actually making latkes. Now, latkes are potato pancakes. I'm going to be making a slew of them this Sunday. And usually what we do is it's for Hanukkah. And we eat a lot of stuff made in oil. Oil is a big deal because, according to tradition, at the time, there was only enough oil for the temple to burn for one night, and it ended up burning for 8 nights, so it was seen as a miracle. And so, of course, you know, we got to eat all this oily food. We got to eat donuts and anything dripping in oil. So potato pancakes are fried in oil. They're delightful. Eastern Europeans eat them with applesauce, with sour cream. They're cholesterol heaven. But anyway, she and her hubby were making latkes and had just lit the holiday candles on the menorah. The menorah has a place for 8 candles, and then there's a 9th place for the shamash. Shamash is the candle that is used to light the other candles. So, we felt a strong spiritual presence in our kitchen last night. No, the wind wasn't rustling up the curtains, and I certainly didn't hear any howling, nor did I experience the type of special effects so aptly portrayed in Ghostbusters. You know, a lot of folks think that in order to have a paranormal experience, you have to have some 5-star Hollywood gargantuan encounter with life after death, like seen on Ghost Whisperer or some of these other shows, the Sixth Sense. That doesn't necessarily work that way. I mean, New Year's Day, what I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be making this traditional Volga German Russian meal that I make every New Year's. And what it is, it's called Biroks and noodle soup. And Biroks are they're a type of meat pastry pie, and I make, for me, I'm a vegetarian, one of those boring vegetarians, so I'm minor tofu kind of thing. And the traditional pies are their meat and cabbage and onions and allspice, and it's in a pastry puff. My family loves them, and then noodle soup. And a lot of times when I'm in there making this traditional meal, I will feel my grandmother's presence because she is the one who taught me how to make these. So it's not, you don't have to have some full-blown apparition walk up to you and tap you on the shoulder. If you have an imprinting or strong sense that one of your loved ones is there with you, they're there with you. Nothing is tacky. She calls that sort of thing tacky. It's tacky. It was more a feeling of an essence. What was this Hanukkah specter vision? A far cry from the apparitions visited upon Ebenezer Scrooge. The spirit was my mother. See, she knew intuitively while making the latkes that it was her mother. Now, please bear in mind that I am not normally given to hallucinations. Do you know that every single time I get an email from somebody and they want to share with me about an experience, some sort of after-death communication, that's the first thing they will say is, I don't have hallucinations, or am I subject to auditory phenomena? But there she was, just behind my elbow, looking much the same as she always did. Yes, I saw her. She did have an apparition. She did have, okay. She was still wearing her strawberry blonde hair tees. Today they would call it added volume. And she looked smart, sporting her good posture along with her pantsuit. Mom had a strong code of ethics and used to always pride herself on telling it like it is. But about her past, she told very little. Splendid opportunity for her to return and disclose ancestral secrets, like the story of Aunt Eleanor and the chocolate pudding. So Mom came back to tell a Hanukkah story to her daughter. It seems that my grandma, Sarah, was rightly renowned for her chocolate pudding. Believe me, this was a pudding to die for. One fine day, she made a batch of the stuff, and my aunt, who was much younger, positively had to have some, so she asked her mother. No, said Grandma Sarah, in no uncertain terms. Case was closed. Grandma Sarah turned and went upstairs and closed the door as well. Do, re, mi, fa. The sound of her scales filtered through the flat. Eleanor seized the opportunity and the handle of the icebox. The 6 puddings sat thickening, each in their little cups. She took one and wolfed it down. dinner that night was a pleasant affair, at least until it came time for dessert when Grandma Sarah was ready to serve her prize pudding. She frowned. There were only five. She became livid. She looked at Sammy first, then my mother, and finally, poor Eleanor, you ate the pudding after I told you no, yelled Sarah. I didn't eat it, protested Eleanor. Annie did, meaning my mother, so she was blaming her mother. Of course, my mother stoutly denied any knowledge of the deed. We will get to the bottom of this, exclaimed Sarah. And get to the bottom she did. A telltale cup of the chocolate remains found tossed underneath Eleanor's bed. Eleanor was roundly punished more for lying and shifting the blame to my mom than for anything else. The fun part of it all is that to this day, Aunt Eleanor claims the entire tale was a total fabrication. And to this day, Aunt Eleanor hates to admit she is wrong. Which brings me back to the spirit of Hanukkah. This apparition shares the joys of Hanukkah's past or present. Did she impart a maternal message about the meaning of holidays and family duty? No, all she said, matter-of-factly, was, that's nice. And it was. So, Miss Cuppasoup had an incredible after-death communication with her deceased mother. Are such experiences new? No, as I said last time we were together, gang, they are not. They have been with us, Jews, throughout history. Jewish Hasidic literature is full of stories describing deathbed visions of famous rabbis. 1 hour before Rabbi Schmeckel died, he saw his deceased father, Rabbi Moshe Lipp, standing right next to him. Oftentimes, when somebody is getting ready to pass, they will all of a sudden see a deceased relative at the foot of the bed, standing next to the bed, and sometimes they'll call out to that person. I talked to somebody just last week who said that her mother sat up in bed and looked at the end of the bed and called out to her mom. He also saw his deceased teacher, the same Rebbe did, Rabbi Mikhail, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement. Those who buried this founder said that they saw his soul leave the earth plane. Now, William Barrett, who, if you want to do a search on him, he wrote a book called Deathbed Visions around the turn of the 1900s. And in this book, he has accounts of being at the deathbed where people actually see the spirit leave the body. These followers of the historically famous Rebbe describe seeing a blue flame ascending through the heavens. So in Jewish tradition, the deathbed vision is not unique. There's a book out there, I'll try to get the title of it for anybody who is interested, that was written by a rabbi. It goes into great detail about Jewish near-death experiences, after-death communications. It goes back into history. It's just a wonderful read. Now, I have always been fascinated with the Christian religion. Now, I'll tell you why I'm so fascinated with the Christian religion. I'm fascinated with the Christian religion because I think that when Mary of Magdalene said that she had a vision of Jesus after he had been buried in the tomb, there was this is what this entire religion is built upon, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I see it as an after-death communication. She had an after-death communication. The body wasn't in the tomb, but there could be a lot of reasons as to why the body wasn't in the tomb, especially back then. My son's actually going to Israel next week, so maybe we can have him go check some of those areas out. Jesus himself had a deathbed vision. All you have to do is just pick up any copy of the Bible, no matter what version it is. Take a look at there would be no New Testament. Take a look at any version of the New Testament. So in Matthew 31, then Jesus began to tell them that he, the Son of Man, would suffer many terrible things and be rejected by the leaders, the leading priests, and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed, and 3 days later, he would rise again. As he talked about this openly with his disciples, Peter took him aside and told him he shouldn't say things like that. This sounds exactly like an account I would receive from some everyday schmo out there who has sent me an email who shares with me that I had lunch with my mother. My mother and I were having lunch. My mother said to me, within a year, I'm going to be dead. I said to my mother, Mom, you're not going to be dead in a year. You're perfectly healthy. Why are you telling me this? You shouldn't be saying these sorts of things. Year rolls around. Mom is dead. Okay? I mean, we're talking, this is called a deathbed vision. My buddy Kevin Williams, who has this incredible site, just plug his name into your search engine. Go to Google, plug in Kevin Williams, and you'll pull up his site. It's all about near-death experiences. He has this extensive amount of energy information on near-death experiences from all religions, all the various authors who were involved in the research. A lot of his writings are on there. But anyway, he wrote a great piece on the after-death communication Mary Magdalene had with Jesus after his crucifixion. The Gospels of Mary describe how. Now, the Gospels of Mary, the church does not sanction this. These are fascinating Gospels. You can plug Gospels of Mary into your search engine and find them. They're very, very interesting. They're not very long. But anyway, it describes how after the crucifixion of Jesus, the disciples were gathered around and weeping. And at Peter's request, Mary tells the disciples about their revelations given to her that were hidden from them. Now, see, she was seen as his favorite disciple. Some investigators think maybe she was married to Jesus. Others think she was a leader in the Jesus movement, which actually was an offshoot of Judaism, which most people don't really understand. It's very interesting history. Anyway, the basis for her knowledge is the vision of Jesus she had in a private dialogue with him. What is incredibly unfortunate is that the 4 pages of the Gospel of Mary are missing, and only the beginning and the end of Mary's revelation exists. Nevertheless, judging by what does exist of the Gospel, Mary's vision certainly resembles a near-death experience. Since it's Christmas time, and of course they've got, you know, the actual date for Jesus' birth is, interestingly, my husband's birthday, April 17th. If you think I'm joshing you, go look it up. Research, scientific investigation has determined that Jesus of Nazareth was born in the spring, and based on a lot of digging around, they have isolated the date April the 17th. But because the church wanted to move pagans from their pagan ways, what they did is they flopped the birth of Jesus right in there, as most of you know, with the winter solstice, and so history was invented. But the revelation is in the form of a dialogue. The first question Mary asks to Jesus is how one sees a vision. Jesus replies that the soul sees through the mind, which is between the soul and the spirit. At this point, the text breaks off. When the text resumes at the end of the Gospel, Mary is in the midst of describing her revelation concerning the rise of the soul past the 4 afterlife powers. The 4 powers represent the 4 of the multidimensional levels of the afterlife hierarchy. According to Mary's vision, the enlightened soul becomes free of their bonds, rises past the 4 powers, conquering them with spiritual knowledge. Now, why isn't this stuff taught in Christianity? According to her vision, the first afterlife state or power she describes is said to be darkness. This may correspond with the so-called void experience by NDEers immediately after death. For any of you who are near-death experiencers, or anybody who's had an out-of-body experience, the first sensation of leaving the body, there is darkness. The second afterlife state that Mary described is referred to as desire. This may correspond to the earthbound realm that people with strong physical desires are attracted to after death. third afterlife state that Mary describes is referred to as ignorance, where judgment occurs. This may correspond with the life review and the self-judgment which Indians often describe. There is this sense during a near-death experience that we basically are being, we are judging ourselves. We're reviewing our lives. We're taking a look at what we did right, what we did wrong, what we learned, the boats we missed. Okay, so it's interesting that this is something that in the Gospel of Mary, this could be found. The fourth afterlife level that Mary describes is referred to as the excitement of death. This may correspond to the feeling of joy that Indians describe when they realize they have escaped from these darker, lower realms and the joy of entering the realm of light. That is the experience. Anybody who has had any sort of contact with the other side will tell you, including myself, contact with that spirit energy is the most loving encounter one can experience. There are not words to describe it. And so here you have the Mary Gospel, her describing this. The fifth afterlife state that Mary describes is referred to as the kingdom of the flesh. Maybe a reference to how heaven has a similar appearance and environment as earth, with mountains, cities, lakes, etc. In a lot of my case files with people who have had near-death experiences or even deathbed visions, what I have gathered are lots and lots of accounts of what heaven looks like. And the common thread through all of these is that it's similar to the earth plane, but the colors are indescribable. Life is indescribable. The music is indescribable. It's very overwhelming for the senses. The sixth afterlife state that Mary described is referred to as the foolish wisdom of flesh. This may be a reference to how living in the higher realms is completely different to living on earth. Seventh afterlife state that Mary describes is called the wrathful wisdom. Surprisingly, this is a good description of one of the afterlife phases in the Tibetan Buddhist afterlife cosmology. Wisdom is also another correlation to the NDE, which frequently involves tremendous knowledge. I mean, a lot of folks who have these encounters, near-death experiences, they do come back. They come back with knowledge. And they'll report this knowledge. Some authors have even written about it. So anyway, I found that very, very interesting. For more information, go ahead and visit Kevin's website. Just punch near-death experience and the afterlife into your search engine and scout around for Kevin Williams' name, and you'll find it. So Jesus knew he was going to die before he was crucified. That's a deathbed vision premonition. Mary had contact with him after he died. Well, I call that an after-death communication. And similarities to the NDE, she was given information about life after death. So that really does, you know, it makes you think. A whole religion has been built on near-death experiences, after-death communications, and deathbed visions. But, unfortunately, clergy and church people, traditional fundamentalists, they see it as heresy if you talk about it. Speaking of views of the afterlife, Melvin Morse, he's a wonderful guy. He's written some incredible books on near-death experiences. He's been researching near-death experiences in children for decades. And he is a bona fide working stiff gang. He's a doctor. He's not some new age guru in tie-dye. He's actually a pediatrician in private practice. And he has been a guest lecturer on NDEs in children's hospitals and teaching institutions and at conferences. They're supposed to have the IANS, International Association for Near-Death Studies, conference in Houston. I think it's either in July or August of 2006. And maybe he'll be there. He's a real sweetie. I really do like him. But he has one account. You know, I was talking to you a little bit about heaven. And I was talking to you a little bit about some of the experiences that everyday people have. And Melvin, who researches the experiences of children, published this just wonderful account of an 11-year-old patient of his who was dying of lymphoma. It's called John's Preview of Heaven. Listen to the similarities here a little bit compared to some of the stuff that I just read to you from the Mary Gospel. In his last days, he was hospitalized with severe, untreatable pneumonia. So he was having difficulty breathing and was in constant pain. He was given very few drugs, such as morphine and Valium, because they made breathing more difficult. I need to explain to you folks out there about the drug deal. People who are dying, if they are working with hospice, hospice will give them just enough medication to make death and dying easy. Hospice does not overload people with drugs. And a lot of people either think that the dying should be blottoed on their way out, just overdosed, or they shouldn't have anything at all. People who have enough medication to take care of any pain they might be experiencing can still be lucid, and they have bona fide deathbed visions, which are identical to those who are dying who do not have any medication. So y'all need to know that. You also need to know that if somebody is dying, trying to force feed them food or water makes the dying process harder on them. So a lot of times people will get really, really scared when their loved ones stop eating and drinking. A friend of mine, his wife passed away, and he kept trying to force feed her, and I finally had to tell him to quit. She wanted to die so bad, and he was trying to keep her alive, and he was making it miserable for her. And once he quit, she had a very peaceful passing. Though this little boy was having difficulty breathing and in constant pain, 3 days before he died, a circle of loved ones gathered around his bed. They were startled. This is obviously relatives, friends. They were startled when John suddenly sat up and announced that Jesus was in the room. He then asked for everyone to pray for him. At about 3 a.m., John sat up again, startling 4 people who had gathered around the bed to pray. And he said, "There are beautiful colors in the sky. There are beautiful colors and more colors. You can double jump up here. Up here! Double jump." At 4 a.m., an extraordinary event occurred. They were joined by a woman who said that she had received a strong premonition that she had a visit, had to visit John right away. So this woman, she had to get to the hospital to see him. She was not known to John's parents, but her son was a playmate of John. She had no explanation for why she would suddenly visit John at 4 a.m., except to explain that she had had a vivid dream about John and felt a need to visit him that was overpowering. How many of you have ever had some spiritual, intuitive happening cross you, and you ignore it? And you ignore it. And it's just, it's strong, and it's pounding, and it's telling you to do something, and you ignore it. Well, we don't listen to that intuitive part of ourselves. We're not listening to our spiritual self. By dawn, it seemed that life was almost over for John. His breathing was labored, and his heart was pounding like that of a marathon runner. That's called, a lot of times when people reach physical death, they have kind of ragged breathing. They'll have kind of a, some people call it a rattling breath. They're not in pain. Let me say that again. They're not in pain. They look like they're in pain, but they're not. Even then, little John had more to communicate. Opening his eyes wide, he asked his grieving parents to let me go. Like my friend, he wouldn't let his wife go. I mean, my goodness sakes, the woman, she was 85. She was so sick. She was miserable. She needed to move on. He would not let her go until a bunch of us put him in a corner and said, "You've got to let her go." "Don't be afraid," John said. "I've seen God, angels, and shepherds. See the white horse." As sick as he was, John still begged his family not to feel sorry for him. He had seen where he was going, and it was a joyous, wonderful place. "It's wonderful. It's beautiful," he said, his hand held out in front of him. This lawyer friend of mine, very straight-laced kind of guy, you know, big law firm, somebody I've done a lot of expert witness testifying for, He emailed me and he said that he was stunned when his father, who was also a very straight-laced lawyer, sat up in bed and said, "It's beautiful over there. I want to go," and then laid back and died. Okay, so soon John laid back and fell asleep. John never regained consciousness and died 2 days later. John's visions and the incidents surrounding them intrigued Dr. Morse. John's mother believes that through God's mediation, John communicated with his friend's mother. Although she knew he had been hospitalized, it was during the period of his most powerful vision that she had to visit John. Though Dr. Morse has nothing scientific to base it on, Dr. Morse believes coincidence is too great for these periods of vision activity not to be connected in some way. Well, during my middle 30s, when searching metaphysical bookstores, periodically I was able to find a tattered book here and there making reference to the deathbed vision. I had had some deathbed visions, but as I've shared with you all, I couldn't find bumpkins on any of this stuff. And in a dark, dusty corner of such a store, actually in England, passed strongly scented incense from India and a stack of colorful tarot cards. I always have tarot cards. You always have tarot cards in this place. It's always got to smell like, you know, it hasn't been cleaned in 10,000 years. Is a shelf, usually a bottom bookshelf, devoted specifically to works on topics like after-death communication, out-of-body experience, and near-death experience. Every once in a while, I would find an account of a deathbed vision. While digging through book titles, it became apparent that published works on visions of the dying and those at the dying person's side were extremely rare. In spite of this, I eventually discovered the deathbed vision of the DBV phenomenon was not a new one. The printed information on this topic was oftentimes difficult to find. My persistence eventually did pay off. Over time, with a little enthusiastic research, I have begun to understand the deathbed vision has been with us for ages, gang. It's been around for ages. When I go back to London, I'm going to go digging around some of these bookstores again to see if I can find some of these incredible texts that were written late 1800s, early 1900s, when people talked openly about departing visions. I have a really good friend who actually sent me a text not long ago that discusses the departing visions of World War I veterans in battle. Great stories. One I just read was of a sister who was in the States who had a visit from her brother who was in Europe fighting the war. And he told her not to worry, that he was well, that he had just stopped by to say he loved her and he cared about her. And shortly after that, they received news of his passing in battle. And a whole book full of those, just incredible stories. Jesus was not the only religious leader to experience a deathbed vision. As I've said, Jewish mystical reading is full of these sorts of experiences. You know, you have the Book of Splendor or the Zohar. This book was written in the 2nd century by a Palestinian rabbi, and DBVs are discussed in detail in the Zohar. Kabbalism, the mystical branch of Judaism, teaches that DBVs should be expected. So, you know, I mean, you can pick up the Zohar. There used to be some crazy myth going around that if you read the Zohar, you'd, like, have trauma and drama in your life. That's more Bupkis study talk. Jewish Views of the Afterlife, that's a good book, too. Go pick that up and take a look at that. The Hasidic branch of Judaism, as I said, was founded in the mid-18th century. This spiritual leader, as he died, he was able to describe to his followers how his soul was leaving his body. I mean, this was discussed centuries ago. And, of course, when he was buried, as I said, his followers saw his soul leave for the heavens in the form of a blue flame. Hasidic literature abounds in stories describing the deathbed experiences of these rabbis, and they're incredibly detailed. After discovering deathbed visions within the literature of two of the most popular religions in the world, I decided that my experiences have not been unusual at all. While investigating the deaths of a number of historical figures, I even came across more examples of historical deathbed visions. You know, okay, so we've got Christmas. Here comes Christmas. And so we'll have a lot of people talking about the resurrection of Jesus. And we'll have a lot of people talking about how we are to behave church-wise. But will one clergy person speak from the pulpit about the paranormal experiences that are associated with the Jesus story? No, they won't. We have Hanukkah. Hanukkah happens on Christmas Day. Those two, you know, usually Hanukkah is not on Christmas Day, but this year it is. Okay, so Friday night services, Saturday morning services. Will there be any rabbis talking about any of these wonderful Hasidic paranormal tales in ancient Hasidic literature? No, they won't. No. And I find that so incredibly frustrating, that there is all this wonderful information, beautiful information, in these two religions that are being celebrated this month that would validate for so many of us our own experiences of after-death communication with our loved ones, just like Mary Magdalene had with Jesus, of near-death experiences, just like Jesus had, just like the Rebbes of Hasidic literature had, world-renowned founding members of major movements in the Jewish religion had. But will anybody talk about that? No, they won't. Will they validate us? No. What's wrong with our religions? Well, anyway, in researching history, I always seem to come across some really interesting tale that's just interesting, not related to what it is I'm researching, but just interesting. And I'm going to end tonight sharing this with you. When I was digging around looking at religion, and looking at the paranormal activities in religion that are right there for us, rebbes seeing their fathers standing there before them as they're getting ready to take off for the afterlife and some of these other things, I came across this really unusual deathbed vision. And believe it or not, it has to do with, of all people, Abraham Lincoln. Now, all of us are very familiar with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you can't escape elementary school out hearing about how the great emancipator was gunned down at a theater by the unsavory John Booth. I mean, they reenact this. They always make John Booth look like, you know, he's going to come get us after he shoots Lincoln. Though we are aware of this famous tragedy, how many of us know that Lincoln had a strange dream about his death several days before he was assassinated? Do you know how many presidents have had paranormal experiences? We'll do that in February for President's Day. We'll go back and we'll take a look at presidential paranormal experiences. In the book Abraham Lincoln, The Man Behind the Myth, by Stephen Oates, this dream, as it was related to Lincoln's friend, Will H. Lamont, is told. "There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me," Lincoln said. "Then I heard subdued sobs as if a number of people were weeping." Now, this is his dream, right before he was assassinated. "I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs. I went from room to room. The same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. I kept on until I arrived at the east room, which I entered. There I met with a sickened surprise. Before me was a table on which rested a corpse. 'Who is dead in the White House?' I demanded of one of the soldiers. 'The president was the answer I received. He was killed by an assassin. This is documented. This is like an awesome departing vision. I mean, Lincoln is seeing his own death. Then there came a loud burst of grief from the crowd, which awoke me in my dream. I slept no more that night, and although it was only a dream, I've been strangely annoyed by it ever since. So, did President Lincoln have a deathbed vision about his own assassination? Was this a warning or just a fluke? I don't think it was a fluke. If any of you still think afterlife experiences are just New Age gobbledygook, I hope tonight's show with me and my cold, I have a raging cold, gang, has changed your thinking just a bit. These experiences, they have been with us for centuries. Sadly, today, we still have difficulty understanding this. If you have a story to share, please feel free to email me at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. I'd love to hear from you. And the time has come for me to go chuck down a whole bunch of vitamin C, a cup of valerian root tea, and I'm going to go get a hot pad, put it on my poor stuffy nose, and probably stick some eucalyptus up my nostrils so I can breathe. And also, I want you all to remember that Service Blog and Radio is here for you, and take advantage of all the wonderful programming that's going on. The hosts of this site are doing an incredible job providing you with wonderful, wonderful information that you're not going to find out there on CNN or Fox News or NBC or ABC or CBS or in your local newspaper. They're giving you a different perspective and introducing you to some people who are looking at the other side of things. And take advantage. You know, check out the message boards. Listen to some of the other radio shows. And enlighten your mind. Take care and sweet dreams and good night.